For those of you who haven't been to this series of groups of things before, we're actually in the middle of, well, no, we're not in the middle, we're very near the end of a year-long theme. And the year-long theme is the figures on what's called the refuge tree of the Western Buddhist order. Basically, they're people, they're figures who, as it were, have brought the Dharma that we practice down to us, the sort of lineage of practices that we practice, so they sort of brought the Dharma down to us. But we're not doing this in a sort of spirit of historical interest or academical interest. We're very much doing it in order to see what these figures, what these people can teach us, can say to us, practicing here and now. What they've got to say to us. They're all people who've added something really vibrant to the Dharma. That we teach, that we practice, and they've all got something really strong to say to us in their different ways. So that's the sort of emphasis. So we've been looking at this for a year, but don't let that worry you. Don't let that worry you. There's only a few left. Don't let that worry you. I'm sure you'll get something. You know, I'm sure it'll be. I'm sure you'll get a lot out of the last few, and then we'll start a whole new series, okay? Which you'll be in on the beginning of. But it doesn't matter. It's a bit like one of those newsreels. You can come in anywhere you like and just see it over and over again. So we're looking at these figures, and we've been looking at, we've got down to the sort of present, and we've been looking at what we call the teachers of the present, and particularly looking at Sangharakshita, the founder of Western Buddhist Order, and the people who taught him. So we've been looking at the people who, his immediate teachers. And tonight we're going to look at somebody called Jagdish Kashyap. Just before I say anything about him, I'll just say that Sangharakshita actually was incredibly lucky in his teachers. He was incredibly lucky in his teachers. In three ways. Firstly, he had managed to have teachers who spanned all the major branches of Buddhism. So he got a very, very broad overview of Buddhism. It's around today. So he also his teachers included some huge figures, included some huge and really important figures. Some of them were famous at the time that he met them, and that they were his teachers, like Jamyang Kenso. And some of them became famous later, like Yogi Chen, who hit it off big in California later, and Chetul Sanye Dorje, who I don't think was particularly well known then at all, but who the Christian writer Thomas Merton subsequently described as the most spiritually developed person he'd ever met. So, you know, we're talking about some sort of serious practitioners here. So all the traditions, very, 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 you know, well-known big people who taught him. But he was also really lucky in that they were all mavericks. Well, not all of them, but most of them were mavericks. They were rebels. They didn't toe the line, most of them. They looked, in particular, quite a lot of them looked beyond the customs and the forms and the dogmas, the inherited stuff of their traditions. They looked beyond that to what the Dharma is really about, to what Buddhism is really about. Like any other spiritual tradition, Buddhism has got a tendency to settle down, to become comfortable and respectable part of conventional society. And when it's become finally a completely accepted part of conventional society, it is then completely dead and useless. Maybe that's putting it a bit strongly. But it was a good rhetorical device. It's not much use when it's become part of conventional society. There's an analogy sometimes used for the Dharma that the Buddha used. He said the Dharma is like a raft. It's about liberation. It's like a raft, and we use the Dharma, we use Buddhism, we use the centers and whatever it is, any aspect of Buddhism, we use it as a raft to get ourselves to the other shore being liberation. And when we get to the other shore, you don't hang on to it. But Sangharakshita used quite a good analogy. He said, well, quite a lot of people's approach to the Dharma, to Buddhism, is very different from that. They have the raft, and it's firmly attached to this shore. And then they build wonderful palaces on it. And they decorate it and they paint it fabulous colours and they have art exhibitions in it. And it becomes the most wonderful raft you've ever seen. But they have no intention of ever casting it off firmly from this shore. It's going to stay here. It's not going anywhere. It's just part of ordinary ways of living. It's very interesting. But it's not going to get us to the other shore. So that tends to happen. And Sangharakshita is very lucky in that his teachings pushed beyond that. His teachers saw beyond that. They pushed beyond that. If the Dharma isn't subversive and frightening and challenging to ordinary worldly values, it isn't the Dharma. It's the sort of Church of England thing. I don't know. It's become the equivalent, Buddhist equivalent of the Church of England. It's become cosy and quaint and about as liberating as a Marks and Spencer's cardigan. So Jagdish Kashyap fitted that mould. He was a maverick. He was a maverick. He was also a major figure in the history of the Dharma. He was Sangharakshita's first major teacher. So Jagdish Kashyap was a monk in the Theravadan tradition of Southeast Asia, and that is the tradition that Sangharakshita was ordained into when he first went forth. So he was a monk, as well as being an academic working in several universities and institutes in India. And Sangharakshita lived with him and travelled with him as his student and his helper. And Jagdish Kashyap was one of the greatest Indian scholars of Buddhism of the last century, especially with regard to the Pali language and the Pali scriptures of the Buddhism of Southeast Asia. As a lecturer and scholar, he had an international reputation. He founded his own Institute of Pali Studies. He was the first person to publish the Pali scriptures in the Devanagari script of India. He was an important translator of the Pali scriptures into Hindi. And when he died, he had a state funeral at which thousands of people turned up. So he was a major figure. He wasn't just some guy. So he was famous, but he was also a rebel and a maverick. He was ordained into the Theravadan tradition. But he was actually a bit, ironical is probably putting it not quite strongly enough of some of the aspects of the Theravadan tradition. The formalism and the conventionality of the Theravadan tradition, he used to mock fairly mercilessly. Especially the formalism and conventionality of his fellow monks. Apparently, many monks attached great importance Many monks in Sri Lanka in particular attached great importance to certain doctrinal and lineage differences in your lineage and doctrine, which were signalled by whether you wore your robe off this shoulder or off this shoulder. So, if you met somebody with a robe off the right shoulder, you thought, a sound man, sound Dharma. If you're off the wrong shoulder, I'm not sure about them. It's a bit like the big schism in the church in England about whether, because the Celtic monks were deemed to be incorrectly tonsured. It's that sort of idea. But there was, so this was a big thing. People wanted to know which sect is he in? Which sect is he in? Is he off the right shoulder? Or is he off the left shoulder? And he used to rather mischievously randomise his shoulders, just to sort of keep them guessing. And then when he was really pressed on it, he said, what school am I? Well, let's see. When it's cold, I wear my robe over both shoulders. When it's hot, I wear it off both shoulders. And when it's really hot, I take the bloody thing off altogether. So he was not above taking the mickey a bit of some of this. This is important to Sangharakshita, who definitely made an attempt to jettison some of the sort of cultural and formalism and the cultural baggage of millennia of practice, which has made him unpopular in certain quarters. So Jagdish Kashyap was a genius and a maverick. What else can we say about him? He was born into a Hindu background in Bihar in northern India in 1908. And even as a schoolboy, he had a reputation for being radical and unconventional. So he was born into a fairly westernized middle-class family, but he insisted on going to school wearing a homespun loincloth and bare feet. So, you know. He was an unconventional figure. As a young man, he was really committed to Hinduism. He was really committed to Indian independence. He was really committed to the sort of Gandhian movement of non-violent resistance. And he decided to stay unmarried and celibate in order to be able to really give himself to his country, to the well-being of his country. But he became very disillusioned with Hinduism. He became very disillusioned, firstly, with the caste system, which he felt that a lot of Hindus just couldn't see beyond. And secondly, he got very disillusioned by reading the Vedas. Apparently, he was really excited about the ideas of reading the sort of holy books of Hinduism. And then when he actually read the Vedas, he said, well, the best way to wean anyone off Hinduism would be to get them to read the holy books of Hinduism, the Vedas, because there's nothing in them. So anyway, that's what he said. So he didn't want to, he decided he wasn't a Hindu. And he found himself very attracted to Buddhism. And he decided to take a doctorate in Buddhist philosophy. So he went to Sri Lanka. He then went to Sri Lanka to study the Pali Canon, which led him to being ordained as a Theravadan monk in Sri Lanka. But he wasn't just a scholar, because he also did a year's solitary retreat in a forest hermitage, meditating in the forest for a year on his own. So, serious practitioner, as well as being a serious scholar. In 1936, I was born in 1908, in 1936 he went back to India and devoted himself to translating the Pali scriptures into Hindi, and into humanitarian work, especially among the sort of more poor and oppressed castes, which didn't make him very popular in some quarters. Indeed, he was even to the point of violence, he was the subject of an arson attack. And he had to go on a pilgrimage, a sort of forced pilgrimage, to let the heat subside from this, that he'd raised. And then in 1940, he was employed as a lecturer at Benares University, which was when Sangharakshita stayed with him and acted as his pupil. So at that time, what was he like? Well, Sangharakshita describes him as very humble, very unassuming, in some ways quite a childlike person, who lived a very simple life with regard to dress, food and accommodation, who was a terrific worker, who could sometimes work day and night without food or sleep, but could equally sleep day and night without food or anything else. He could sleep for India, apparently. Yeah, Sangharakshita was very impressed that you could ask him these really abstruse questions about the Pali Canon. And he'd be lying there in his hammock, and he'd hardly open one eye. And he'd quote chapter and verse and perhaps deliver a half hour, a really precise sort of little discourse about the precise meaning of a phrase, and then go back to sleep again. Apparently, without having apparently woken up. But on the other hand, he would work really hard when there was work to do. He was apparently very dark and very, very fat. In fact, he was so fat that when he took a tricycle rickshaw, he would always pay the rickshaw wallah double price. as a sort of bonus for having to cart somebody like him around. And Sangharakshita went to live with him in 1949 to study Pali and Buddhist logic. And during this time, apparently Sangharakshita got very concerned with the idea of going beyond the self. How do you go beyond the ego? How do you go beyond the self? And he thought, well, how do you go beyond your sort of little likes and dislikes, when you're always making your decisions, you're inevitably making them on the basis of your likes and dislikes, your conditioning. How do I go beyond that? And he was very impressed to come across a book called Certain Seeds of Contemplation by a Christian author, Trappist monk and author Thomas Merton. in which he says, well, the way to really overcome ego in the Christian tradition, in the monastic tradition, is to just give up your will to your superior in the monastery. You just say, well, I'll do what you want. I won't make decisions on what I want. I'll just do what my superior wants. I'll do what they say. So Sangha actually thought, well, that would do it, wouldn't it? I mean, there'd be not much scope for your own personal likes and dislikes. You just say to somebody you really trust and admire, well, you tell me what to do and I will do it. So he did that with Jagdish Kashyap. Said, I'm going to practice this with regard to Jagdish Kashyap. But Jagdish Kashyap was probably the worst person in the world to do this with, because apparently he was like really so unassuming and so kind and so considerate that he was always going, well, what would you like to do? You know, no, I mean, that's only if that's all right with you. You know, and sort of you can take your. So I mean, he wasn't very good at being the sort of guru, whatever, the director, the spiritual director in a way. But he rose to the occasion. He rose to the occasion because they were off travelling. They're off travelling in the Himalayas. They were in the town of Kalimpong in the Himalayas. And he thought, well, right, I'll take this Sangharakshita at his word. And he said, right, I tell you what you should do. You should stay here and work for the Dharma in Kalimpong. So Sangharakshita didn't particularly want to stay in the middle of nowhere working for the Dharma, but he'd undertaken this, so that's what he did. He stayed there and he worked for the Dharma. And that had a big effect, actually. Had an enormous impact because he stayed in Kalimpong, which is on the borders of Tibet, it was one of the main routes out of Tibet. Not that long afterwards, he started to meet up with all these very impressive figures from Tibetan Buddhism who were fleeing the Chinese, which really influenced the style of his practice and sort of gave him a much wider perspective on Buddhism. That's one of the things. And really formed the way the FWBO practices, and gave him the idea of bringing sort of unified Dharma back to the West. That's one thing. But it had another effect, I think, as well, because sort of the effect it was intended to have in going beyond the ego in terms of Sangharakshita's development. So he took on board, he was going to just stay there and work for the Dharma, irrespective of his moods or his passing enthusiasms, or the adversity that meant, or the criticism that meant, or the people who, the people who tried to stop him doing that, the difficulties. I stay here and work for the Dharma. And taking on a task like that, sticking to it, despite adversity, despite bits of yourself that aren't really behind it, etc., 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 it builds, well, the old-fashioned way of saying it is it builds character, it builds strength. It integrates the different conflicting parts of ourselves, would be a more sort of modern way of talking about it. It integrates the different conflicting parts of ourselves behind the project. So it gets you beyond self, because you go beyond personal likes and dislikes, but it also builds the self in the sense that it builds strength and integration and a sort of united being, if you like. And that's the area I really want to look at tonight in terms of Jagdish Kashyap. The whole area of non-self, of getting beyond the self, as contrasted with self-development. So Buddhism talks a lot about non-self, but it also talks a lot about self-development. So how do we sort of square that? I think it causes a lot of confusion with people. And it was an area that Jagdish Kashyap had some really quite pronounced views on. He had some views that his fellow Theravadins sometimes found too challenging to listen to. And Sangharakshita has also, I think, taken on some of his points of view. And some of his views are too challenging for some Buddhists to listen to. So, So what of this business about non-self? So it's really well-known Buddhist teaching, isn't it? There's the three marks of conditioned things. The three marks of conditioned things. All conditioned things, including us, are marked by impermanence. Everything changes. Everything is a process. unsatisfactoriness, not very happy with that as a word, but I mean it means that the changing things of our experience, our external experience, can't give us lasting satisfaction, and they are lacking in self-nature, or anatman. So the things of our experience do not exist in themselves, of themselves. Anatman, that's the Sanskrit word for that. And that, I mean, actually, if you ask a lot of people about what they know about Buddhism, that would be one of the things they would come up with. Oh, non-self, non-duality, non-self. Nothing has true selfhood. Nothing exists independently from its own power. Everything depends on something else. So it's one of the basic insights and ideas of Buddhism. But it's really easily misunderstood and misinterpreted, and it can be quite dangerous when we do that. So Jagdish Kashyap had some of his own ideas about this. Quite famously, he gave a talk, he gave a sort of Dharma talk to a group of Theravadan monks, in which he said, well, let's look at this idea of non-self. Let's look at this idea of anatman. Because it's actually more complicated than it's sometimes thought. And to really understand it, we've got to understand the previous Hindu idea of anatman, of atman. So anatman means lack of self. And Atman means self. And you've got to understand the sort of Hindu philosophy behind it that it was building on. And apparently he was jeered from the stage. They said, oh, we don't want any of your Atman. We don't want any of your Atman. We, you know, non-self, that's it, non-self. He wanted to look at it and, you know, what does it really mean? But it's really tempting. A lot of people want to think in terms of sound bites. An Atman, good. Atman, bad. So non-self, good. Self, bad. Sound bites and slogans. Thinking in terms of sound bites and slogans. Instead of really thinking, well, what does this mean? And they didn't want to hear what it meant. So what does it mean? An Atman. We don't have a self. We don't have a self. What does it mean? At one level, it's complete nonsense. Utter nonsense. Of course we've got a self. We've got patterns of way we think, feel and behave that persist through time. Mine are different from yours. If I do something today, it has an impact on me tomorrow and next week. And it perhaps doesn't have anything like the same impact on you. If I don't pay my mortgage, it's me that ends up on the street. And I need to remember that, because otherwise, you know, if I behave in particular unskillful ways, if I'm really cruel, then it's me, actually, it's me that sort of, my personality suffers for that, not yours. Of course we've got a self. Pish. Yeah. Non-self, non-schmelf. Something like that. Nonsense. So what? Okay, at one level, but why? Okay, so why does Buddhism say we haven't got a self? Why does it say we haven't got a self? It says we haven't got an Atman. We haven't got what in Hinduism they call an Atman, a fixed, unchanging self that's independent of everything else. Okay, that's what Atman meant. It's very easy to show logically that we don't have an unchanging, an independent self. I am different now from what I was when I started practicing the Dharma. I'm different from when I was 12. You know, I'm different today from yesterday. When I'm angry, I'm more like you when you're angry than I am like me when I'm loving. You know, I mean, in one way, you know, we're constantly changing. We're constantly changing. If I look at pictures of myself when I was 35, I don't recognise myself. I've got black hair. You know, we're constantly changing. We're not a static thing. We're a process. We're a process, an ever-changing process. And we're a process in the midst of all sorts of other processes that we're constantly interacting with. We don't exist independently. We're supported by all things around us. In order to exist, I need the ecosystem I'm part of. The atmosphere vanishes, woof, I'm dead. Yeah, I'm constantly interchanging molecules with the atmosphere, constantly taking in water that's been in the sea, giving it out again, it goes back into the sea. taking in energy that's been thrown down to the planet by the sun, using it to move around, expending it. I am only the way I am because of all the influences of all the people I've met, all the sort of books I've read. I can only exist the way I do because of the society I live in. I'm supported and influenced by an infinite number of conditions and events and phenomena. Everything from the ecosystem that I'm part of to being part of the Sheffield Sangha to being part of the human race, the UK, etc., etc. And all these are all changing processes themselves. So, I mean, actually, I exist, we exist, not like a static thing among other things. We exist like, more like, say, an eddy in a stream. If you've got a stream that's got loads of eddies in, those eddies have got a self. They've got a sort of, they exist. But they don't exist independently or unchangingly. They're constantly changing, and they're constantly interacting and influenced by all the other eddies around them and exchanging material with them. They're processes within a much bigger process. So that's how we exist. More like eddies in a stream than like collections of things. There's loads of analyses you can use. You can also start thinking about, well, we're built up of independent parts or semi-independent parts. Each of our cells sort of gets on with it, and we don't know anything about it. They're almost like selves themselves. They just get on with it. And they're built up into organs, and they just get on with it. And then there's me. I mean, I'm made up of my organs. And then I'm part of something bigger. I'm part of an ecosystem. I'm part of a Sangha in Sheffield. I'm part of an order. I'm part of the human race. I'm part of an ecosystem. So everything sort of is composed of smaller things, and it's part of larger things. There's a philosopher called, Kessler, who talks about this, and he says, well, everything exists as what he says, he calls it Janus-faced holons. Ooh, that's a long word. Janus, I think, is a Roman god who had two faces. And a holon means something which is a sort of a self, but not a self. And it's Janus' face because it's always composed of smaller things and part of larger things. And where you draw the boundaries, it's composed of smaller processes and it's part of larger processes. And where you draw the boundaries is completely arbitrary. I'm no more a self than my liver is a self, etc., etc. Or that society is a self. The boundaries are artificial. Another way of looking at it that Buddhism traditionally uses is a question of control. So if something is me, I should be in charge of it. If it's me, I should be in charge of it. I should be able to tell it what to do, because it's me. Well, I can't tell my body what to do. I can't say, well, actually, I'm sick of being 5'8". I want to be 6 foot. It doesn't take any notice of me. I've been doing it all my life, and take it from me, it hasn't taken any notice of me yet. I can't change my hair back to black. I can't control my body. I can't decide, my kidneys are getting on with it. I can't sort of tell my kidneys, okay, let's speed up or slow down. I can't tell my liver speed up or slow down. I can't tell my cells speed up or slow down. I don't control my body. My body gets on with it. If I had to think about the muscles in my arms and how I have to move them to do that, I couldn't do it. It's really complicated. My arm is much more self than I am. It gets on and does it. So I don't control my body. I'm not in charge of my body. So how can my body be me? Yet surely our body is a big part of what we think of as ourselves. And it goes on, it takes the analysis further. Well, the same is true of feelings. I can't decide what I feel. I can't decide what I think. I can't decide what I will, what my volitions are, etc., etc. So where is the self that I'm in charge of? And if I'm not in charge of it, in what sense is it a self? So here's a quote from somebody called... Edward Conza, quite a famous Buddhist translator. The self which appears to be in full control is a multiplicity of factors and divides itself against itself, as is shown clearly in temptations, self-defeating actions, phobias, etc. In any incompletely integrated person, conflicting impulses point to different centres of control rather than a unitary self. You know, I mean, if we were selves, then you know, every New Year's resolution we'd have made, we'd have kept, because we'd have been in charge. But are we? Well, I leave you to decide for yourself. So, in one sense, we're a self. Yeah. Non-self, non-schmelf. You know, in one sense, we're a self. And in another sense, we don't have a self. Yeah. It's just words. It's just words. Anatman, it's just words. We have a self or we don't have a self. It depends how you look at it. But the question is, do we need to undermine our sense of self to make spiritual progress? The Buddha was never interested in philosophy for philosophy's sake. So, I mean, his take on it was, the nature of reality is beyond the intellect. The nature of reality is beyond the intellect. So it's not actually that productive to sort of spend a lot of time saying, well, what's true and getting into metaphysical speculation. What is interesting is it helpful? Does it help us to grow and develop? Does it help us to manifest the potential that we've got? That's the acid test, not is it true? And the Buddhist tradition carries through with this emphasis. It's like, well, is it helpful? Is it helpful? Anatman, the concept of anatman isn't there because it's like the nature of reality. It's there because, well, is it helpful? Does it help us to grow? Is it helpful to stop thinking in terms of a self, or isn't it? And again, what you say is, it depends. It depends on where you're at in the spiritual path, actually. And your background. For a lot of us, especially in the relatively early days of practice, by which I probably mean a few years, the idea of insight, of practice being about insight into non-self, is not that important. It's not that important to our practice. And too much emphasis on it could even be harmful. Too much emphasis can't be harmful. There was a guy called Nagarjuna who appeared in this series in the form of Vajratara having a debate with me, who was one of the great sort of philosophers of emptiness, if you like, in the Buddhist tradition, one of the great philosophers of the non-self doctrine. He said, it's better, so he's the big advocate of this whole idea of non-self, but he said, it's better to have a self-view, a self-image, a sort of self-esteem as big as Mount Meru, which is the biggest mountain in the world, but to have the most enormous Everest-sized sort of self, than to have a wrong view of emptiness. And he also said this idea of non-self is like a snake. It's like a snake. If you pick it up the wrong way, it will bite you, and it will be fatal to your spiritual life. That's okay. So he's saying, well, there's this idea of non-self, and it's true in a way, and it's helpful to some, but if you get it wrong, it's completely poisonous. It's completely poisonous. So why? The reason why is that a lot of our practice for many, many years is about developing ourselves. It's about developing ourselves. It's about developing qualities in ourselves. And if we have too much emphasis on non-self, we won't take that idea seriously. We won't take the idea of karma seriously. We won't take the idea seriously that what we do now actually develops the self I am in the future. We might not take ethics seriously. We think, oh, well, you know, non-self, I don't exist, he doesn't exist, let's nick his stuff. We won't take developing positive qualities, which is traditionally described as accumulating merit. We won't take that seriously. We'll try and go for insight. You know, give me insight. But we won't be big enough to have insight, because the way we see the world is a product of the sort of being we are. And to have insight, we have to grow to be the sort of being who can have insight. And that means developing ourselves. So we need to develop ourselves. And if we're thinking too much in terms of non-self, that really undermines that goal. So just for example, the sort of questions we might ask ourselves is, well, if I don't have what's called continuity of purpose, so if I don't have an aim or a goal in my life that makes my life meaningful, if I don't have the strength to stick to that goal through thick and thin, whatever my passing moods, whatever the obstacles, whatever I feel like at the time, whatever my enthusiasms, whatever other people say and undermine me, then I need to think in terms of developing a strong, independent self, not in terms of getting rid of myself, not in terms of non-self. Or if I don't have the sort of healthy self-esteem and self-love that allows me to feel really good about myself and have that overflow into feeling good about others and rejoice in others, then perhaps I need to develop a strong, healthy self and not think in terms of non-self. And so on. So, I mean, you can carry on with that. So, and then you could also say, well, on the other hand, if I do have that sort of real continuity of purpose, I can follow through on my resolutions. I can sort of follow a thread. I can keep going with something, whatever I feel like. I can do something that makes my life meaningful, and I feel really good about myself. But all I use that for is, you know, my own likes and dislikes, making loads of money, something like that. Then maybe we need to sort of get rid of that idea of self, and open up to something much bigger than just being about our own little selves. So it all depends on where we are. It depends on where we're at.